underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In her new novel, Touch, author Courtney Maugham tells the story of a leading trend forecaster who suddenly finds herself in the position of wanting to overturn her own predictions. Drawing on her own professional experience as a forecaster and corporate namer, Courtney examines the salient issues of technology, family, and artificial intelligence. Courtney Maugham is the author of the novel, I Am Having So Much Fun Here Without You, and the chapbook, Notes from Mexico. At various points in her life, she has been a trend forecaster, a fashion publicist, and a party promoter for Corona Extra. We come to you this week before a live audience from Edith Wharton's The Mount in Atlantic, Massachusetts, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Courtney Maugham to this week's book show.
I just clapped for myself.
That's good. It helps with the sound effect aspect of it. Don't you feel when you do something like, this show just seems more special. If we were in the studio, this would be special, me talking
Definitely.
To you. But the fact that we're doing it in Edith Wharton's barn, there's something about that that just adds to...
There's some pressure, a little, for me, as a Edith Wharton fan and a fan of the Berkshires and the Mount. But it is... triply exciting, I would say, to be here live.
Now, I read a little bit in the introduction about your past background, which I was not aware of while I was reading the novel, I must admit. And I was thinking as I was reading the book, which is about a trend forecaster, mm-hmm. a woman by the name of Sloan, we read about in the novel. And I'm thinking to myself, I really like this because Sloan is a trend forecaster, and that just comes off as kind of a bullshit position. Bullshit job to me. Now, then I learned that you were a trend forecaster, and then as you read the book, you realize, there is actually something to it.
That's so funny you say that, I think it exemplifies how little people know about trend forecasting, the fact that you would think it's a BS position. See, the tricky thing about trend forecasting is that the companies who have enough money and clout to use trend forecasters certainly do not advertise the fact that they use them, right? So like an Apple, especially with the passing of Steve Jobs, is going to carry on his legacy by pretending that they are not consulting any of these oracles, same with a Nike or cosmetic companies or any. They want people to think that they're just coming to these amazing realizations at the right time with no outside help. But the truth is that most companies across many different industries are using some version of trend forecasters or trend forecasting. When I did it, I was nothing compared to Sloan Jacobson, my story's main character, who is in the industry, a household name. And there are such household names today. Lee Edelcourt is one, Faith Popcorn
yes.
is another. But I worked for a trend forecaster, really it was just one woman. I worked with her, and we worked almost exclusively with luxury beauty brands, and we worked on the future of texture, scent, and color.
All right, I'm not sure you'd change my mind, but
okay. Let me...
But what I find interesting is, because very early there's a character in the novel who says, isn't it just sort of...
Yeah.
It's contrary, it's opposite. So it's slim jeans today and tomorrow it's the opposite.
You have now given me a challenge, which is to convince you. So in fashion trend forecasting, when you're going season to season, especially, fall 2017 to fall 2018, 100% it's a game of opposites. It's about, it's high-waisted, bell-bottom pants. This fall for women, you can be sure that within a year, it'll be tiny, tiny micro shorts. And the fashion industry gets a lot of flack for that because it's just forcing people who follow fashion to overconsume and not really invest in maybe some pieces that can stand the test of time. So there's a difference between trend spotting, which takes place within 2 weeks to a year out, and trend forecasting, which can be 2 years to 20 years. If you think about something that's kind of far out there, not fashion, because the fashion trends are the most obvious things, right? Right. You see people wearing a certain color, a certain height of shoe. When you really think about trend forecasting and the kind that is highlighted in Touch, it's really about trends and desires. So now, I don't know how often you get out of Albany. but
not much.
For anyone who here, you know, does get out and perhaps stays in hotels, you might notice, and you could discreetly raise your hand if you've noticed, that in the past couple of years, we've started to be exposed to something called scent branding, where hotels will have their own branded scent experience. You've noticed that?
Yes.
So you might walk into the lobby of whatever hotel and think, someone started a campfire? Oh, that's so alluring. Oh, it reminds me. And it's supposed to conjure up these sort of either nostalgic memories or aspirational. So maybe it's a grapefruit lemongrass scent and you think, oh, this smells healthy. It makes me think maybe I should get that $180 massage. Anyway, but that scent branding started to happen somewhat recently. And there was someone or a team of people probably 10 years ago who were working toward the moment when companies, hotels and other places who usher people through their doors were ready to pronounce their identity in a scented way. So it's that kind of work. It's thinking about what do people want to smell like? What do they want their shampoos to smell like? How will deodorant change? How will the idea of perfume change in the years ahead, more than, you know, will people be wearing black or white or, you know, neon? Although that color work is very fun, but it goes deeper than that and it's a lot stranger.
So with all of that said, it seems my reading of the novel is that it is a satire of what you have just described of looking at how far we can take this and to a point where we want to rein it in and actually have something that is real.
So it is a satire. I mean, I think it's a satire with feeling. And to me, a satire is about, you know, it's a cultural work or creative work rather that makes some sort of cultural commentary. And to me, it's a satire of consumerism and smart technology and our dependence, nay I say addiction, to smart technology and the way our smart devices have sort of made us these lemmings that go toward trends without taking time to reflect about, for example, do I really like rosé? Do I? Is it good? Does it not make me feel kind of sick? Or, you know, do I need a... what are those mattresses called?
The memory foam.
Right. Am I comfortable on this mattress? Why am I buying this? Perhaps you do and you like your mattress. But you know, there's things like that around. Okay, for another example. Do humans honestly need a video camera to show them if they're backing up correctly? I mean, is that not going to cause more accidents? So, I mean, in the book, I'm trying to get people to reflect again before blindly buying things, but you know, the larger book is about connection.
About connection and ultimately touch, of course. Tell the audience and us about Anastasia and how this novel, which takes place like this much into the, my fingers are about an inch
like apart tomorrow.
From each other. Yeah, just an inch away from where we are, where there is a driverless car with a name.
So Sloane Jacobson, the main character, the trend forecaster, she's been hired to work for a huge company called Mammoth, which it's a turducken. It's a satire of Amazon, Apple, and Google. And they make everything. They make absolutely everything, including driverless cars. And they have outfitted Sloane with one, and she is contractually obligated to drive it to be driven in it everywhere. Now, Sloane Jacobson, and this is why the book is also about one woman's personal journey back towards connection and a better relationship with her family. She's a very successful woman, but she's completely estranged from the people around her. She doesn't have close friendships. Her love life is a dumpster fire. And so very early on in the book, you see that her closest relationship is actually with this driverless car named Anastasia, partly because the car is outfitted with this thermal sensor technology, and Anastasia can tell when Sloane is stressed. She can tell when she's lying. There's almost a lie detector thing going on where she can see the tones of the changes in tone of voice. She can rate her heartbeat. You know, it's almost like traveling inside of a Fitbit. So the car actually does want what's best for her, and in wanting what is best for her, manages to be the only person in the book who can draw out some you know, personal information and regrets that she's been holding inside of her for a really long time.
How does she come to the point where she has such strong feelings at a relatively young age of, I don't want children?
Right.
There's a line, reproduction is akin to eco-terrorism.
Right, which is a line she ends up regretting somewhat because her sister, with whom she has a really difficult relationship, is super maternal, is about to have her third child. Her mother's very maternal. So how does she end up with that conviction?
That feeling. And that strong of a conviction.
Well, she, is this a spoiler? I don't think it is. She loses her father, who she was incredibly close to, at a relatively young age. And the pain of that loss for her as a teenager translates into, I never want to allow myself to love someone that much that if I lose them, it hurts this much. And in her young mind, and even as she becomes older, because in the book she's 39, if she loved her father that much, she would only love a child more, she assumes. She sees how much her sister loves her children and the sacrifices she makes for her children. And she just doesn't, she's scared. And, she's got a high level of freedom. She's got this high-powered job, travels all over the world. And for decades in the book, it's great and it's working really well for her. It's only when she's about to turn 40 and her partner, you know, life partner, decides that he doesn't want any penetrative sex anymore, that she starts to wonder if she's not walking down the wrong road.
This, we see this very early in the novel, that this is a woman on the cusp. You write, and she's talking about her partner, and he is, as you say in the book, in bed mating with his tablet.
Yeah.
Seeing him there otherwise engaged made Sloane want to run back across to the main house where her mother was surely still up, spill out her unhappiness like something ill-digested, exchange reassurances over something hot and honeyed, be tucked childlike into the guest bed down the hall. So there's that cusp, that wanting, knowing that it's there and thinking that that is something that would be comforting.
Yeah, I'm sad listening to that. I just think that's a really sad part of the book because I think that happens to people today all the time, especially within families or friendships that are beginning to fray because we do spend so much time maintaining our friendships digitally or our familial relationships digitally that when you finally see them, you feel like you're up to date with their life, right? But mm-hmm. You've seen the pictures of their kids, you've seen what they've been doing with their weekends, but it's not the same, it really isn't the same as having a tactile relationship with someone. And I think what the excerpt that you just read shows a Sloane who, she's in this committed relationship with this guy, it's been 10 years, but they couldn't be further apart, even though they sleep together. He's constantly in his, you know, second life online, whereas her mom, who birthed her and she grew up with, she's just there right, you know, down the hallway, but it's just been too long and she doesn't feel that she can touch her, literally. She doesn't feel that she can touch her or be touched by her mother anymore. But at the same time, I think she realizes that if they could just reach that embrace, that a lot would be forgiven.
As I said, it's a character on the cusp of just realizing this as life moves on and coming into a second act, if you will.
Yeah, no, definitely. It is a second act.
I there were just a couple of sentences that I highlighted because I just loved. And the house and its outcrop of random buildings were like a stone rubbing of her parents' marriage, proof that they had been there, proof of what they'd been.
That house in particular in Touch is based on the house of my best friend growing up in Stamford, Connecticut, which was a place that I was at all the time, all the time. My parents had a very stormy relationship and, you know, were divorced by the time I was 9. And that place on, Long Ridge Road was a refuge for me. And it was, in this story, my first book is about adultery. In this story, the parents' marriage falls apart because the husband dies. But I do think that homes, even if they go on to be sold to someone else, and landscapes, they can hold such powerful, you know, memories and connotations for people. And yeah, I like that line that you read, because she's just seen she's just confronted with these memories of what she had and the happy childhood she had, and she still has a happy family. It's just she's not part of that picture.
There is this idea in the book of what's coming down the pike, of premonition, and how those ultimately all come together. I'm interested in that because I think all those things could happen and we wouldn't necessarily connect the dots.
Mm-hmm.
But here the dots are at least presented to us to allow us to connect them.
Yeah, which was tricky to write because, you know, it's a backward process. Everything had to be connected in my mind and then I had to deconstruct it. But well, she's hired. I mean, here we have a woman who's hired for 6 months by the world's most powerful country. Country. Well, it's like, Amazon's like a country, right? Sorry. Right. Whoops, slip of the tongue. World's most powerful company to work with them for 6 months to help predict the next trends in technology. And the problem is that somewhat early on, while she's working for them, she really starts to get these inklings that maybe the next big thing in technology is no technology and people stepping away from technology and moving towards face-to-face interaction. And she calls it in-personism and tactility again, which is a huge problem, number one, because it flies in the face of what her company does. It's probably going to get her fired. And she's also very worried that these feelings that she's having, which are premonitions, which she's always been able to trust her instincts, because her love life is imploding and because she's close to her family again after like 16 years, because she lives in Europe and she's back on the in the Northeast for the first time in a long time. For the first time, you know, she's not trusting her instincts anymore. Some people are accusing her of being, you know, oh, her hormones are taking over. It's her biological clock, which is a terrible thing for a woman to hear. But yet she's about to be 40, so is it true? She can't decide. She can't decide whether to go rogue within her company or to kind of lie to herself and just make up trends that she actually doesn't believe in.
Talk about the partner, Roman, who you refer to, her relationship with him as a dumpster fire.
Yeah.
That, because he's a weird dude, right? I mean, he's
definitely
a big deal.
Well, he's becoming a big deal. So, I mean, Romain Bayard is a French neo-centralist. He has dubbed himself a neo-centralist, which means he thinks about tactility and sensuality in the digital age. He came from market research. Procter and Gamble, that's how they met. They met in a consumer focus group. But he slowly sort of turned himself into this kind of intellectual pundit, and he's been lecturing all around Europe, and he does so in a Zentai suit, which is like an integral cat suit, but it covers your face. It covers everything. there's no access to any body part. And so he's decided that this is his avatar.
And that's a real thing?
That is a totally a real thing. Maybe even in Albany, there are communities dedicated to Zentai all across the country, all around the world. You can Google it in your free time.
Yeah.
But it's quite striking. You know, it's a fetish. It started off in the fetish community, and there are people that the reason my character wears it is because it's a commentary about tactility, and he can be seen as a person, but he can't be touched. And his whole belief is that sensuality and sexuality is moving into the augmented reality space, and it's going cyber, and it's a much more interesting frontier than our actual physical IRL life, right? So that's just his sandwich board, right, that he's wearing around. Now, in the non-book world, people actually wear these suits. They have their own reasons for doing so, but they become quite domestic. Like, people wear them around their houses with their spouses and stuff. And at one of my book events, at Book Passage in Corte Madera, they surprised me, and I never got to see his face because, again, you can't see the person's face, but a man came dressed in the Zentai suit. And so we have some fun pictures that are circling around online. And then my husband, as sort of a gag and a show of support for me, also wore one at a different event.
I like that you call it a surprise. My mother always used to say that there's a fine line between surprise and shock.
No, I mean, it actually was a lovely surprise because not only he wasn't just some dude who came to the event. He was a bookseller's husband who came speaking French. There was a whole thing going on. And it turns out that he's a pretty successful actor. I had to find out all this after the fact because, again, I never got to see who he was. But I guess that's his thing, is he plays quirky French actors. And he used to play a quirky French actor on Cheers.
The one suit is red. It's like
a he's got a whole fleet of them, but he's risen to...
One is sort of worn.
He likes the gold. Yeah, one's frayed. The green one's pretty frayed. And he's risen to internet celebrity. I mean, massive, massive, numbers of followers because of Instagram. He goes out, and when he was in France, he would ride the subway in them. He would buy his, market supplies, get the baguette and everything. He'd take a photo of himself sitting on a bench in Paris with a baguette that he couldn't eat because his mouth is not accessible. You know, he's known in Europe, and as Sloane and Roman arrive on the East Coast, he's starting to become picked up in America as well. New York Magazine runs a profile on him, and so Sloane is watching this sort of take off, and it's not great news for her. It's pretty bad news for her relationship.
And these are things that help her understand that there is more to life than a world that does not allow us to touch, to feel, to have a connection.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, when Roman was in Europe and these photos, the Europeans were treating him as a bit of a novelty, but when he gets to America, he starts publishing his thoughts about the death of penetrative sex, and Sloane is astounded to see that people are, instead of laughing at, they're really embracing what he's saying, and that there's a lot of people who think that, first of all, overpopulation is a huge problem, and so reproduction doesn't really need to be occurring right now. And that there is a wilder badlands of sexuality to be explored online. And I mean, much of that can be true, right? I mean, you can be a pterodactyl, you can be a centaur online, you can do whatever the heck you want.
You can be a reality star and become president of the United States.
I didn't know if we were gonna go there, but there's another, not
which
a lot.
Which you predicted, by the way.
I did, unfortunately. I'm not proud of that, but. Ugh, now you've thrown me off because
I'm sorry.
Now I'm just depressed. But I'm glad you mentioned him because there is a sub plot in this book that no one's picked up on. But so maybe I didn't do such a good job. But it is also supposed to be a satire of how Clinton was more or less set up to fail, and how we do still have a misogynistic culture. That are you not aware of that? You're making a face.
No, I very much picked that up. On the
book. Oh, you? Well, you're a genius.
A genius in early Albany. The name of the new novel is Touch. It is published by Putnam. Courtney, Mom, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much
for being with us. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Thanks to Edith Wharton's The Mount in Lenox, Massachusetts, edithwharton.org. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.